From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we talk with several people whose compelling stories are featured in the new book, Voices of Multiple Sclerosis. The collection of essays offers candid, heartfelt, and inspiring testimonials of 40 diverse individuals who have been affected by the crippling disease, including Dr. Terry Walls of Iowa City, who overcame secondary progressive MS through intensive nutrition and exercise coupled with electrical stimulation. Jessica Lipnack, who suffered stretches of bone-splitting agony before her MS suddenly loosened its grip. And Carol Hunter, who describes the dark journey her MS sent her on. The Voices of MS. Join our discussion after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Currently, at least 400,000 people in the United States have the disease, with another 200 diagnosed every week. Worldwide, over 2 million are thought to have it. What is it? Multiple sclerosis, a chronic, often disabling disease of the central nervous system. Its progress, severity, and specific symptoms are unpredictable and can be very different from one person to another. And this fact presents special challenges in the diagnosis and treatment of MS. This hour, we talk with several people whose compelling stories are featured in the new book, Voices of Multiple Sclerosis. The collection of essays offers candid, heartfelt, and inspiring testimonials from many people across the country who have been affected by the crippling disease. Three people whose personal essays appear in the book join us this hour by phone. Let's welcome Dr. Terry Walls of Iowa City. She is has MS. She is also Associate Chief of Staff at the Veterans Administration Iowa City Medical Center and Associate Professor at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Walls.
Good afternoon.
You had a busy day of clinics. Otherwise, we would have welcomed you to our Iowa Public Radio studio. Thank you for making time for us in your busy day.
Excellent. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us from West Newton, Massachusetts, Jessica Lipnack. Are you there?
I certainly am. Hello. How are you, Ben?
I'm fine, Jessica. Thank you for joining us. And from Minneapolis, Carol Hunter. Good
yes,
afternoon.
Yes, I'm here too. Good afternoon, Ben.
Great. We're all hooked up. I'd like to go through some of the things that we've read in this book, your personal cases, and more or less take it chronologically. And, of course, we have the great advantage of having Dr. Walls with us so that we have the medical insight into this disease as we go along. And we'd like to reach out to our listeners this hour. If you have MS, how has your life been affected by this disease? We'd like to hear about your experience, Exchange listeners, as well. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us. TheExchange@iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Walls, because you are a physician and have been affected by MS, you have a unique perspective on this disease. Describe what happens in the central nervous system of those affected by MS.
Well, the body begins attacking itself, and what we see is damage to the insulation or myelin on the wiring of the nerves. That makes it difficult for the brain to communicate effectively with the muscles, leading to weakness. It also can make it difficult for the sensory organs, like the eyes, balance, sensation, to communicate effectively with the brain, leading to problems with vision, balance, or neuropathic pain.
How does that result in this huge spectrum of symptoms? You can see it in these essays, clearly demonstrated. Sometimes it'll affect vision, sometimes walking, fatigue, depression, all over the board.
Well, we really aren't sure what the first driver is that causes MS. It may be an infection. It may be something in our food, in our environment. So that leads to a large variety of experiences in terms of how severe the disease is or into how rapidly people decline, mm-hmm. which makes it very challenging to study as a researcher.
Tell us how you first became aware of your MS, Dr. Walls.
Well, in retrospect, it happened during medical school when I started having neuropathic pain. And then several years later, I had an episode of blindness. And then in 2000, I had an episode where I had foot drop, that is, I was stumbling over my left toes. That was when I was finally diagnosed. But I'd had about 20 years of symptoms before then that had not been very well explained.
So
typical.
MS was one of the possible suspects, but it had not been nailed down for over a period of 20 years.
Correct. Well, it had never been considered, actually, until I had the foot dropped. And that's very common. People with MS and other autoimmune illnesses, we have symptoms for years prior to people having enough information to put the puzzle together.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the day that you were diagnosed?
Oh, I had just submitted my resignation a few weeks earlier. I was planning on moving to Iowa. My doc had said, there's something wrong with your brain or spinal cord. This might be terrible or really, really terrible. And so as I was laying in the scanner that night, I was adding up my life insurance, thinking about the fact I may be losing my health insurance. And so I got to go through 2 weeks, the same thing my patients go through, is the specter of a terrible diagnosis, financial ruin. It was a very enlightening time period.
Mm. More empathy with all types of patients as a doctor because of it, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
You describe in your essay the difficulties of continuing your work, and you did come to Iowa, presently at the VA Medical Center, as described. I was interested in your essay. You pointed out the two sorts of challenges you had at the workplace, the challenges of your deteriorating physical condition itself, getting into eventually into a wheelchair, but also the challenges of telling your colleagues and working with your colleagues in this new context. Talk about that, too.
Well, I didn't want people to know that I had MS. One, I didn't want any kind of favoritism. But I think the other real issue was that MS is a progressive disease, and I was afraid people would call into question my competence as a physician leader, administrator, as a physician because of concerns about potential cognitive or impacts on my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to hide it very much. And then when my doc told me I needed to get a wheelchair because I was having so much issue with fatigue, that was very challenging to get into that wheelchair, to face the stunned looks of all my colleagues.
Mm-hmm. And did it eventually work itself out?
Well, I decided that if I wanted to continue to be a leader, I had to project optimism and confidence in the future, so I kept smiling and telling everyone things are going to be fine. And what I discovered was that by saying optimistically that everything would be fine, after 3 days of saying that hundreds of times, I began to feel a whole lot better that, yes, things would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a terrible driver, of course, at first, driving with a joystick. And I got my wheelchair hung up with the desks of our appointment clerks.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started making jokes about being a terrible driver and needing driving school and laughing, that reassured my staff, and it reassured me that I had not been defeated, that life really would be okay.
In fact, you write in your essay, why is it we are not teaching our young doctors about the healing power of laughter?
That we clearly should be doing. All sorts of physiologic changes occur when you laugh, which actually reduce the immune problems greatly. So laughter is wonderfully healing.
Any studies you know of about the healing power of laughter?
Yes, there are studies that have shown a lot of the inflammatory cytokines go down, natural killer cells go up, and Norm Cousins, as you may recall, is the guy who used intense laugh therapy to overcome a malignancy.
Hmm.
It's very effective.
Let's turn. We have a remarkable story of recovery to tell from your perspective, too, Dr. Walls. Today you were up walking about, even riding bikes, miles
right.
and miles. We want to get to that recovery a little bit later, but let's turn to our other two guests. Jessica Lipnack joining us from, where did we have you? In West Newton, Massachusetts,
yes.
where you live. Looking
yes.
down at my notes. Sorry,
yeah.
Jessica.
Close
you,
to Boston.
You write in your essay, I'm quoting, "It was 30-odd years ago that I woke to a sparkling June sun and a body completely numb from my rib cage to my toes. It started that suddenly, without a yellow light or a distant oncoming horn, and another two decades would pass before it had a name. Again, we have a long time before a diagnosis. What were the difficulties you faced in getting a diagnosis?"
first of all, I was in the hospital with that first episode. I was, of course, terrified. Had absolutely no idea what was wrong with me. I literally woke up, put my head forward, and had a symptom that's called Lhermitte sign, which is it feels like a shock of electricity going down your spine. And it was with that shock that I went numb. And I didn't feel my feet again for another month. I went into the hospital. The neurologist was completely stumped. The year was 1975. I was just turning 28. And neurologists had no idea what was wrong with me. They had very, very primitive ways of diagnosing MS. What was that, 35 years ago? Do I have that right, 35 years ago? Mm-hmm. And, what they used at that time, and Dr. Walls will know what this was like, was a procedure called a myelogram, where they stick a very thick needle into your spinal column and usually miss and hit some nerve roots, and it's extraordinarily painful. And they shot some radioactive fluid into my spine to look at and see what the obstructions were. They couldn't figure it out. And essentially, the neurologist told me he had no idea what it was, and I could come back to see him if I wanted to, but he really had nothing to offer me. So I left there having no idea what was wrong, and had a number of bouts over the years. And then it was a very protracted migraine headache that led to my diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Walls, let me turn back to you. Diagnosis of MS these days compared to decades ago has improved dramatically, I assume.
Yes, yes. That's because of the MRIs. It's easier to see these lesions than it was 10, 20 years ago.
So the MRIs, once you have that scan done and you see the white, what do we call them?
Plaques.
The plaques on the brain, then you know for sure what's going on.
Well, you often still need a spinal tap. You need a few other confirmatory items, but it's easier to put together the puzzle because we have easier diagnostic tools. And unfortunately, the frequency or the number of people getting MS is increasing, and we see children getting MS now as well.
Why would that be increasing, or is it just the diagnosis of it which is increasing?
Well, we think pretty clearly the frequency is increasing. There's a lot of debate. My theory, I would relate it to our change in diet and increasing toxins in our environment as certainly key parts of that puzzle.
We have to take a short break. Dr. Terry Walls with us, along with Jessica Lipnack from Massachusetts, Carol Hunter with us from Minneapolis. They are three of the voices of multiple sclerosis, this new collection of essays, people who have multiple sclerosis sharing their experiences, The Healing Companion, stories for courage, comfort, and strength. And we'd like to hear from you if your life, especially if your life has been affected by multiple sclerosis. We'd like to hear about your experience or your questions. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to the Voices of Multiple Sclerosis, that's the title of a new collection of essays, and we have three contributors to that collection with us today, Dr. Terry Walls of Iowa City, Jessica Lipnack of Massachusetts, and Carol Hunter in Minneapolis contributing to this collection. We're listening to their ideas, their experiences, and hopefully yours as well as we get into the hour a little further. Carol Hunter, let's turn to you in Minneapolis. Your first symptoms of MS began with your vision. Describe that.
Happened at first as my eyesight was very blurry. I kept thinking it was an allergic reaction, kept rubbing my eyes, and then it just kept getting dimmer and dimmer. And as I put in the book, it was like looking at an old black and white negative. And then it just went black, and then I was blind in my left eye. I kept thinking it's an extreme migraine, something is wrong. I went into the emergency room. I was very fortunately referred to an ophthalmologist who specializes in optic neuritis. I was very fortunate. He caught it right away, sent me to a neurologist, and I had an MRI done, and it was optic neuritis. I, like Dr. Walls, was very, very quiet about it for a very long time until very recently, because you can hide it. You know, I responded well to the medication. My eyesight did come back. I've had other episodes. But really just didn't want anybody to know. I didn't want to look vulnerable. I wanted to be strong. So when the MRI results came out and I saw all the patches or the plaques, it's all over the screen, I was really devastated and very scary because you just don't know what the future is going to bring.
And as you write in your essay, also very scary because of how your marriage was ending at the same time that the MS got worse and diagnosed. It points to the importance brought from your essay of a good support network of friends and family, especially when a chronic disease like this is discovered.
Correct. Yes, it was very difficult. I had to drive myself to the doctor. It was not probably my best driving moments. I just would get in the right lane and just stay in the right lane. I would literally like bump off of curbs, but I had no support. He would not take me to the doctor, that type of thing. You learn you just have to be very strong on your own. I do have some wonderful friends and some wonderful family, and that's one of the positive parts of the disease is it got me closer to other people. And I definitely, more than survived, I feel like I excelled through it. So,
okay, let's go to our first callers. Vicki is joining us from Sutherland. Hi, Vicki. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Go ahead.
Well, my diagnosis, I think, was a little bit different. In 1975, I was a teacher and was very happy and very satisfied as a teacher and had a very, very settled job and so forth. And suddenly we got news that my husband's job was moving him, and I just reacted with all kinds of odd symptoms, odd things. I became very numb, especially a band of numbness around my stomach and my abdomen. My legs were numb. My vision became blurred, and I was stumbling. My speech was affected, just my words were slurred. I went to my doctor and general practitioner. He said, I don't know what's wrong with you, but we have a neurologist who visits here every other week, and I'd like him to see you. And so I talked with this. I went to an appointment, and I was with this gentleman about 10 minutes, and he said, he said to me, "Are you a strong person?" And I didn't know what to say. I said, "Well, I think I am." And he said, "I think you have MS." And that's how I found out. And I didn't really know and did not have an MRI until 1991 or 1992 that confirmed that. But what they did do when that diagnosis was made in 1975, I went to the hospital and I had 10 days of MHTC, I believe that's in the initials of it, which is a strong steroid for children who have very bad asthma. And I was very numb for a long time after that. The numbness wasn't due to the MS, the drug, but I didn't know what it was, but I thought it would go away, and I just kept it to myself, and my husband and I kept it to ourselves that I had MS. Because we didn't know, we knew that, we read about it, and we knew that there wasn't anything my family could do if I told anyone, so I didn't tell anyone.
Vicki,
that I had it.
Yeah, Vicki, how are you doing today?
Okay, I am at secondary progressive MS, and if I don't exercise and I try to follow Dr. Wall's guidelines, dietary guidelines, and I do think that makes a difference, but sometimes I have a difficult time getting all the green vegetables I need to get. Because I can't find them in, you know, anywhere here in Northwest Iowa. But in any case, I'm doing pretty well. I have to rely on my walker, a cane. I have a wheelchair as well, but I don't use it. I try not to use that so much.
Mm-hmm.
I walk with a stumbling gait, kind of, and my balance is lousy. My vision's clear. And I think I'm doing pretty well.
That's good. That's good to hear. Vicki, calling from Sutherland. I want to raise the point that you raised, go further into it, because Dr. Walls, we've been alluding to it, and I want to, in the 3 or 4 minutes we have before the break, have Dr. Walls talk about the treatment that she's been developing. In 2000, Dr. Walls was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and in this secondary progressive MS, you were severely disabled by the disease to the point where you were dependent on a wheelchair just 2 years ago. Today you walk, even ride a bike. You've had this experience put in an audio CD called Up From the Chair. Tell us about your recovery and what you think led to it.
So in the last 2 years, I've gotten steadily stronger. In October, I was able to do a trail ride in the Canadian Rockies. I attribute this to the intensive nutrition, lots of green leaves, sulfur-containing vegetables, brightly colored fruits and vegetables. I also take B-complex vitamins and sulfur amino acids. In addition, I use neuromuscular electrical stimulation many hours a day, moving the electrodes from different muscle group to different muscle groups, and do a physical therapy program that gradually progressed over those 2 years. So it was a rigorous exercise program, but it was easier because of the electrical stim. And I have easily 9 cups of fruits and vegetables every day, probably 3 to 6 cups of green leaves, and then 3 cups of bright colors.
MS, is, as you well know, is an unpredictable disease. Some get progressively worse. Others have symptoms that fluctuate. How do you know this is not just a fluctuation that would have happened whether or not you had done anything?
Well, a couple of things. I was in the secondary progressive phase, so for 4 years I'd gotten steadily worse without any benefit. If I travel and don't eat as many greens, as much kale, I can tell that my back pain goes up. Or if I eat dairy or grain, the joints in my right hand get sore. My fatigue is markedly worse, and I feel bad for about a week. Mm-hmm. So food sensitivities clearly are a problem. When I've had to send in my neurostim device for repairs and have been without that for 48 hours, that does not feel very comfortable either. So I'm very careful to maintain all of that, and I've learned to travel with a big bag of kale in hand to make sure I can eat as much kale.
Kale is your spinach, so to speak.
Yeah, kale is king.
For more information, we'll talk about Terry's research later in the hour as well. We have to take a break in just about a minute, but I want to make sure our listeners have access to your website, Dr. Walls. It's at www.terrywalls.com. TerryWahls.com. A lot of information there, Dr. Walls.
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
And I should also say I'm submitting a grant to the NIH to test our protocol in a very big way. So we're excited. Hopefully we'll be able to get funded.
Very quickly, in just a few seconds before we have to take this break, how do you think kale or whatever helps the neurological system? What's going on?
Because it is so rich in B vitamins and it's so rich in sulfur. The two are critical to the brain physiology and biochemistry. So if you do nothing else, have as much kale as you can. Have either cooked or raw every day. Fabulously good for you.
So those green leafy vegetables, vegetables of all kinds, of all colors.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll take a short break. Dr. Walls, please stay with us. Joining us from the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Iowa City. She also is a part of this book, Voices of Multiple Sclerosis. One of the voices is Dr. Walls, along with Jessica Lipnack, who joins us from Massachusetts, and Carol Hunter from Minneapolis. We'll be back with more on multiple sclerosis. These experiences, fascinating experiences. Perhaps your life has been affected by MS. We'd like to hear about your experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, listening to the Voices of Multiple Sclerosis. Voices of Multiple Sclerosis, the title of a new collection of essays written by those who have been affected by this crippling disease. Stories for courage, comfort, and strength. Joining us, Dr. Terry Walls from the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Iowa City, and Jessica Lipnack, from featured in the book, from Massachusetts. Carol Hunter from the Twin Cities joining us. We'd like to have you join our conversation a little bit later. Phones are full, so we want to go to the phones in just a moment. But first of all, I want to mention, too, in this collection that Terry Garr, the Academy Award nominee, actor Terry Garr, has MS. She has an essay in this book as well. It's interesting. She talks about the stigma she faced once it became known that she had MS. even though she'd been acting for years with MS, suddenly the phone stopped ringing with offers. And I'm wondering, let me talk to you, Jessica, in Massachusetts, did you encounter this sort of stigma?
I think it's a tricky question because it depends how your symptoms present and it depends on how much you talk about it. I can remember just around the time I got my definitive diagnosis, which, as you know, I said earlier, was 20 years after, I was doing I'm a writer, and I do management consulting, and I was working with a client, and the client, I had mentioned to the group that I was working with that I'd gotten my diagnosis, and the client took me aside and said, "Don't tell anyone this," as if it were a big secret that I shouldn't mention. Anyone who looked at me, I don't have the kind of symptoms that I had when I originally had my onset, or when I have what's called relapsing remitting, which is a different kind from Terry's and from Carol's and from the caller previously. So I have moments when I, you know, nothing is bothering me, and then I have other moments where I have many of the symptoms that have already been mentioned, and someone might notice but probably wouldn't. So I think it's a judgment call as to how much you want to talk about it. Terry talked quite honestly about how she had to sort of go through that process. I talk about it all the time, and yet I find people will say things to me like, "How do you get around? Are you getting around okay?" And that's not, you know, that's not where I am with the disease at this point. So I think what you're dealing with is people's anxiety when they hear about it, that it would happen to them or it happened to someone that they know, which is, I think, one of the values of this series that we've contributed to. There are many books in this series. We have one of eight books that LaChance Publishing has put out in this series, Voices of Various Diseases. Mm-hmm. I think it is quite therapeutic for people to be able to see that other people are experiencing these kinds of things and talk about it.
Do people ever have the misconception, the notion that perhaps you can catch MS from someone?
I do think people think that, and I think also it's a very misinformed view, but Terry pointed to something that I think we have to be terribly concerned about, which is the environmental changes and the upswing, the velocity with which MS diagnosis is increasing. I live right outside of Boston, 8 miles outside of Boston, and in a little more than a one-acre area, right around my house, three of us have been diagnosed with MS. So that makes us wonder whether there are indeed environmental causes, whether indeed the early Vanderbilt study that was done about it being a pathogen, in fact, is what's going on. We have many things to look at. I have to say one other thing, Ben, because Kerry talked about kale. This is very interesting. I have a natural desire to eat kale. I wonder what Terry would make of that. But I have a what's the word for it? You know, when you want something, a yen for it, there's another word. Crave it.
I crave
kale.
Do you crave kale too?
I crave
too?
Kale.
Yeah. The reaction in the studio during the break from a person here on staff was, "How in the heck do you eat raw kale? We know it's a very bitter plant."
Just bake it or saute it a little with garlic and olive. It's delicious.
And Dr. Walls, I know on your website you have a number of recipes, raw and cooked, of kale consumption.
Yes, yes.
Okay, let's get to some phones because there are a lot of people who want to join our conversation. Sonia is in Cedar Rapids. You've been waiting. Thank you for waiting, Sonia, and welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you. I knew about multiple sclerosis, but I didn't know what caused it. And after today, after hearing it, it kind of sparked my interest as an electrician. It seems like multiple sclerosis attacks the insulation of our nerve system. And if you looked at electrical system, if your insulation is being destroyed, it's because too much heat is going through the electrical system. So I think it would make a lot of sense to have the connection to your food, is if you're eating food that is causing a particular person to have too much heat build up in them, then it would destroy the insulation on your nerves. I don't know if that may.
Let's turn to the doctor about this. Anything you can comment on there, Dr. Walls?
Well, it's an interesting thought that there's something with the neuron that leads to the myelin breaking down. I still tie this back to the environmental toxins We're having 3,000 new chemicals added every year, and most of those receive no testing for any kind of information on how they attack brain cells. And if you don't eat your greens, your sulfur, your color, your body will have a hard time getting all of the toxins out of your body.
Thank you, Sonia, calling from Cedar Rapids to Muscatine now. Linda, hi, Linda.
Hello. Well, I crave kale, too. It's hard to find. But
we're going to have a run on kale after this show in Iowa. Better be planting some more.
Well, over the years, I have read about people taking 10 or 20 years to get a diagnosis, and for me, it's been since about 99, I'm guessing. And I had met a lady in the MS community who was in a wheelchair, and I just guessed that maybe this, it was MS that she had, and talked to her, and she said, well, I hope you don't have doctor, I won't say his name, but, and I said, oh, yes, that's him. And she said, well, he's notorious for not diagnosing people very well, that it may take 20 years for him to get around to it. And I was diagnosed right away with fibromyalgia, and I had heard something about that maybe being classed in similar somehow to MS. I have a cousin that has MS, and when I told her the problems I was having, she said, well, I know what you have. It's what I have, MS. Mm. And what is your comments about that? I know usually when I have an episode, it's in warm weather. I thought around Thanksgiving I was doing the classic progression of symptoms as they always come down, and turned out I had shingles.
Mm. So let's get the word from Dr. Wall's advice for those who suspect something or suspect perhaps a misdiagnosis. What do you do?
Well, it's very, very common for fibromyalgia years later to be re-diagnosed as MS. And one of the best things anyone can do for their health is to eat 9 cups of fruits and vegetables, stressing green leaves, sulfur-containing vegetables, and bright colors. That's probably the single most important health advice I can give anyone.
Okay. What about selecting a doctor if you think you might be at the wrong address with your doctor?
Well, we always have a chance. We should always be able to find physicians that we're comfortable with. And then I would begin speaking with friends and colleagues, asking for their suggestions to find another physician. Absolutely, if you feel uncomfortable, uneasy, it's fine to either tell the doc directly that you're looking for a second opinion or to begin talk to your friends and colleagues.
We had a caller call in who's dropped off the line, but the note here is that Peter called in to ask about the so-called hygiene hypothesis. Dr. Walls, what's that?
That's thinking that by doing all the vaccinations, having so few infections, either bacteria, viruses, and parasitic infections, that our bodies are generating this immune response against ourselves. There's a lot of epidemiologic evidence suggesting that, and there are some studies that have used inoculating people with pig whipworm to treat inflammatory bowel disease very successfully. And I believe there are some studies happening in Madison that I don't know the results in the study yet, but they've been inoculating MS patients with whipworm and then doing serial MRIs.
Mm. Let's go to Fairfield. Alan is joining our program. Good afternoon, Alan.
Yes. I wonder if anyone has looked seriously at the possibility that the infectious agent in MS could be mold or fungus.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I asked that question is that the woman who has the website Mold Misery, MOLDMISERY.com, she says that she has observed fungus actually demyelinating nerves. She has observed it under the microscope happening.
Mm. Okay, Dr. Walls, another one for you.
Sure. There is plenty of evidence that mold in some people will elicit an immune response. And so if you have a mold sensitivity and MS, that will dramatically worsen your disease. And it certainly is possible there are a variety of infectious bacteria and viruses that have been associated with a higher risk for MS. If you have a mold infection in your brain, most of the ones that I'm aware of would kill you rather rapidly. So I think it's more likely that there's a mold allergy, which is like turning the fires to high underneath the soup kettle. And so it'll make the disease much more active, much more vigorous.
Jessica Lipnack in Massachusetts, you write in your essay in this collection about, well, many of these essays include the search for the silver bullet, an alternative treatment that will improve the symptoms quickly. And you write, Jessica, I see several more chiropractors leaving them behind one when one, an ugly old man, old enough to be my father, slobbers a kiss over me. I see homeopaths. The first uses the word weird when I describe my symptoms. The second prescribes tablets made from snake venom. His office smells like rotting food. Now, as someone newly diagnosed with MS, I suppose it sounds like, in reading these essays, you have to really be aware of snake oil peddlers, Jessica.
Yes, and I don't think anything that I did in the alternative world hurt me in any way at all. And I would encourage everyone who is diagnosed or has any kind of autoimmune disease to pursue all alternatives. The incident with the chiropractor was disgusting, and it could have happened with a traditional doctor as well. And the doctor that I have, the neurologist that I've been seeing for so many years now, is a very traditional guy. You know, he's the head of the sleep disorder clinic and a top neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, which everyone who's listening to this program has heard of, a very traditional place. But he supports my search for any kind of alternative. I followed a path very similar to Terry's, Dr. Walls, without having the medical background to do so. You know, I eat a very good diet. I've done yoga for many, many years. I exercise. I do all of the, you know, the healthy things that you can possibly do. And apparently, I eat kale because that's what my body wants.
Mm.
So I think there's both it's a both and in this situation. I definitely would go to a traditional doctor who can give you the diagnosis and can give you the medications that you can need if you need to take them. And I would do every possible alternative that's out there. They can't really hurt you. And the examples that you read from a small snippet of the fact that I had gone to everyone that you can imagine and continue to try to get alternative approaches. And I think all of it together has helped to make me quite healthy, given what I'm coping with.
You're right, Jessica. It was some 30 years ago that you woke up with that completely numb feeling from your rib cage down to your toes. Then suddenly you write in your essay nearly a year ago, I am better.
Yeah.
So what happened? I hope you're feeling better today, too.
Yeah, I feel good. I feel good. I just, there is a very strong psychological component to this. And Terry talked about it again at the beginning, talking about the role of laughter, the role of joy in your life. You know, Norman Cousins, the editor of Saturday Review, was the one who first kind of put that in front of us, that we could use our natural internal healing powers to feel better. Now, I'm not trying to say go heal yourself. Certainly, that's ridiculous if you've got a very serious neurological disease, which is what all of us on this call have. But knowing that, there's still a lot you can do to help yourself. And ultimately, feeling better is a choice you make every morning. You make that choice every morning. And I make the choice. Even though I had numbness last night, and as Terry mentioned, I had terrible back pain last night, these things come, and you just kind of say, well, am I the pain? No. Am I the numbness? No. I'm me. I'm happy. I'm going to do what I want to do, and maybe I have a few limitations.
Over to Carol Hunter in Minneapolis. You write in your essay about the trials that you've had with MS have taught you compassion toward other people that you wouldn't trade for anything now. Talk about that.
Yes, that's true. I actually also work in social services, so I work with people with varying degrees of disabilities, and I think it really gives me an understanding what they're going through, and it definitely gives you perspective every day.
So it made possible a career change for you and gave you the understanding, the compassion to pursue that career.
Yes, and it also, I agree with Terry and Jessica, too, on the positive. You know, people always say, you're so joyful, you're so happy, you're so positive. I think my clients actually help keep me that way, and I think it really just gives you a perspective of just, keeping a great attitude. I totally agree with the diet, too. And I always encourage my clients to eat leafy greens, healthy diet. I'm a vegetarian. I think that makes a huge difference. But I think when you're working with other people that have things, I tell my clients all the time, we all have something wrong with us. We're all human. It's just, you know, you do the best you can. And most people I know are pretty interesting. You know, they have their struggles, but they're pretty interesting people.
Let's go to Cambridge. Cammy is there. Is this Cambridge, Massachusetts, out where Jessica is?
No, this is Cambridge, Iowa, 20 minutes from you.
Oh, okay, very good. We have a few minutes left. Welcome to our program.
Okay, then I'll cut to the chase here. I am a relapsing, remitting MS person. I was diagnosed in 2003. I do incredibly well. I've been very open about my MS. I ride horses, I train horses, and teach people to ride, so I know a lot of people. And I tell almost everybody I know that I have MS because a lot of people are newly diagnosed, and they are scared. And they, you know, everybody's thinking about being in the wheelchair or, you know, the worst-case scenario or whatever it is. So I like to show them that, you know, if you're lucky and if you play your cards right and if you take care of yourself, the future for you can be very bright.
So getting diagnosed, if you're newly diagnosed and you're in that category, as 200 people per week are in this country, adding to that estimated at least 400,000 diagnosed MS people, it's not the end of the world. In fact, we can point to Carol's case, a graduate from college with honors after her diagnosis, with only that one eye really working well. You traveled the world, Carol, and
yep.
it led you to a new career in social services.
Right, exactly. Very good.
Let's end this program by going around the horn and asking what you hope those who suffer from MS and those of us who are on this planet living with those people will take away from reading this book. Let me start with you, Jessica, in Massachusetts.
Going inside, this is going to sound almost trite, but I really mean it. Going inside and taking a look at what you have and doing what you can with what you have. Also writing about the negative feelings. I was encouraged to write that essay against my will. A friend of mine said, you've got to write about this. I hated writing about it. The essay has now been published twice, and I'm speaking about it. So it's quite a...
Even though you're a professional writer, you love writing.
That's right. Even though I'm a professional writer, I live to write, and I couldn't write about this because it was so painful. I'm on the other side of writing about it, and I feel better. Go figure.
Okay, Jessica, thank you. And to Carol Hunter, the final thoughts you have, what do you hope people to take away from
I'm with Jessica on this. I'm also a freelance writer. It was, but when you're writing something this personal, it's very difficult. I was finally to the point where I'm not going to be silent about this anymore. It can help somebody. It can help dispel some of the myths about it. And you can realize it's not a death sentence, that you can do pretty darn well.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to mention that this Voices of Multiple Sclerosis book is part of a series of books. There is Voices of Alcoholism, Voices of Alzheimer's, Autism, Breast Cancer, and if you'd like more information about this entire series of Voices of books, you can find more information at thehealingproject.org. Dr. Walls, what would you like to be the takeaway for our listeners, for the readers of this book?
Laughter is very curative. It lets you be in control of your life.
Laughter.
And then, of course, I want to push again, more kale.
More kale and laughter. Well, you know, you've talked about laughter so much this hour. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you if you have a good joke to end the hour.
Oh, forgive me, I do not.
Anybody, Jessica, have a good joke?
No, but you're gonna tempt me to come up with a good stand-up routine about MS. Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll definitely include kale.
All right, that sounds great.
Dr. Walls, tell us, because we'll check back in when this happens, tell us more about the future. You're the lead investigator on pilot studies to verify.
We have pilot studies that will test this protocol that's under review. I anticipate getting approval, hopefully in the very short term. I'm negotiating with MP to get funding for that study. I'm also submitting grants to the NIH for funding. I will have a book coming out, Mind Eat My Mitochondria, that talks about all of my theories in much more detail, and I'll let you know when that's closer to press.
We have a few seconds left. Remind us again exactly what these studies will be testing.
We'll be testing intensive nutrition in neuromuscular electrical stimulation in the setting of secondary progressive MS, who normally just gets steadily worse. our theory is that we'll be able to dramatically improve their ability to walk, and I think we'll also see measurable improvements in their ability to think and in their mood. Our very early preliminary data actually is strikingly positive, and so we're trying to do this in a somewhat larger group of folks.
Very good. Thank you. We'll look forward to more information on that as those studies develop. More information about Dr. Wall's work at www.terrywalls.com, TerryWalls.com. I want to thank you, Dr. Walls, for joining us from Iowa City. Also, Jessica Lipnack from Massachusetts and Carol Hunter from Minneapolis, all voices of multiple sclerosis in this new collection of inspiring stories for courage, comfort, and strength. Thanks to the three of you for joining us this hour.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
And, of course, to all the callers we had this hour joining our conversation, making it so interesting this hour. Our exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, our technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and available podcasting and on-demand audio are available at our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.